listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Comparisons to Joan Didion and Nora Ephron, Susan Sontag, and even George Orwell get tossed around when the two gifted essayists we'll hear from tonight are lauded in the press. Leslie Jameson's collection, The Empathy Exams, was cited in the New York Times for its, quote, ethical generosity, the palpable sense of stretch and reach, and the lovely vividness of the language itself. About Megan Daum's essay collection, The Unspeakable, Cheryl Strayed wrote in the New York Times, Daum's powers is one of the most emotionally exacting, mercilessly candid, deeply funny, and intellectually rigorous writers of our time are on glorious display. These are two highly original writers whose subject matter often overlaps in intriguing ways. In the great essay tradition, they write about their own lives, creating a mirror in which other people can recognize their own humanity. If empathy, as Leslie Jameson suggests, is a kind of travel, a journey into another person's pain, what are the ramifications of making that journey or not? What if the territory we traverse is uncomfortable and messy? The events we witness there are unspeakable. From a mother's deathbed to the operating table during an abortion, what is our tie to those we care for, to those who care for us? We will explore some of that territory in tonight's reading and conversation. Most of you know Megan Daum from her columns in the Los Angeles Times, where she's been an opinion columnist since 2005. She's the author of three previous books, including the essay collection, My Misspent Youth, and her essays and reviews appear widely. We also have her new anthology, Selfish, Shallow, and Self-Absorbed, 16 writers on the decision not to have kids at the table tonight from our library store. You can read Leslie Jameson frequently these days in the New York Times Book Review. Her debut novel, The Gin Closet, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times First Fiction Prize. She's currently completing a doctorate, or as she says, some unfinished business at Yale University. And she lives in New York, where our perceptive interlocutor, Molly Polda, now lives since she's decamped from Los Angeles, where she was a provost postdoc fellow in the humanities at USC. Molly's currently teaching at Barnard and Brooklyn College and working on a manuscript on secrecy in contemporary literature and culture. Please join me. It is my great pleasure to welcome, I think we'll first hear from Megan tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow, we have a lot of academic degrees sitting up on the stage. Thank you all so much for coming tonight, and thank you, Louise, for having me. It's really always such a treat to be here. It's an incredible thing we have here in LA, Aloud, and the library, so I'm always thrilled to be here, and it's really a pleasure and a privilege to be here with Leslie and Molly. Really so happy when I heard about all of this, so thank you. Okay, so my book, The Unspeakable, is a book of essays that have, among other things, are concerned with the idea of sentimentality in American life, and most of them sort of explore this idea that, you know, we go through life and we have these experiences, and there's a kind of mandate to respond to them in a particular way, to kind of feel a kind of sappiness or have a cathartic experience or learn a lesson from your experience or something like that. And there seems to me there's a kind of tyranny around that. And so most of the essays talk about having experiences and not sort of feeling emotionally connected to them enough. The piece I'm going to read from is called The Dog Exception. And it's about how sort of the one thing for me that I actually get incredibly emotional and sappy over are animals, and particularly dogs. So, and I'm just warning you, I've only read this out loud one other time, and I have avoided reading it because I was afraid I was going to cry, and in fact, I did. So we're going to try it again. I'm just going to keep reading it until I have no emotion whatsoever around it. So I need your support. Okay. A week before my dog Rex died, I submitted his photo and biographical details to a website called The Daily Puppy. As examples of oppressive internet cuteness go, the DP is in the upper stratospheric reaches. People send in photos of their puppies, accompanied by descriptions that are often in the first person, as though the dogs have composed their own dating profiles. The goal is to win a coveted Puppy of the Day slot on the homepage, a designation that invites a trail of gushing comments on the order of, "Oh, you precious baby," and "You are so furrylicious, I could hug you for hours." The site also has a category called Grown-Up Puppy of the Day. And one morning, as I looked at Rex and got the distinct feeling he didn't have that many mornings left, I gathered up a handful of his best photos. Rex on the beach at Big Sur, Rex in the flower garden, Rex in front of the Christmas tree, and uploaded them to the Daily Puppy's submission page, along with his somewhat grammatically challenged personal ad. "My name is Rex, and I am a grown-up puppy. My humans say there's never been a dog loved as much as me." And it should have been I, so that he was got that wrong. And he got, the submissions weren't actually that stringent because he was grown-up puppy of the day the next day. So FYI, if you want to submit your dog, don't stress. Okay. I won't lie, Rex's passing a week later was the worst grief I've faced in my life so far. Even weeks after the fact, I had bruises on my forehead from where I dug my fingers in while sobbing. Even when he'd been gone for nearly a year, during which time I acquired two new dogs for whom my fondness grew every day, his absence felt like a hole I was forever stepping around. I often thought about how, as a high school actress with desultory ambitions of growing up and going pro, I'd worried about my inability to cry on cue. In the era of post-mortem Rex, and actually for months prior, when, despite his relative spryness, the mere anticipation of his demise had me choking up on a near daily basis, I pictured myself triumphing as an inconsolable, suicidal Ophelia, summoning images of Rex while flooding the scenery with a monsoon of tears. But it was not just Rex himself that brought out such blubbering. Upon his death, as though enduring a series of aftershocks nearly as traumatizing as the main event, I had the misfortune of receiving from several well-meaning parties a copy of a poem called The Rainbow Bridge. Actually, to call it a poem might be pushing it. It's more like a pitch for an for an animated children's show that's been broken into lines of verse, except it doesn't always even appear in verse form. Sometimes it's more like a five-paragraph essay. Often you'll see it printed out in a fancy font on pastel-colored paper, like a morbid wedding invitation. On YouTube, there are multiple video versions, many featuring gauzy footage of clouds and pastures and using the music of Enya, surely without permission. The idea behind the Rainbow Bridge is that there's a vast green meadow this side of heaven where pets that were especially loved by their owners go when they die. In this meadow, which is also the entry point of a bridge that is literally made out of a rainbow and that leads to heaven, all sickness disappears and all injuries heal. The animals return to the spirited, bright-eyed creatures they were in the prime of life. In this meadow, there is always fresh food and clean water, and the sun always shines, and the animals spend their days frolicking happily together, though they always miss the special human they had to leave behind on Earth. Every once in a while, however, one of them stops suddenly and looks into the distance. Body quivering, he leaves the group and runs across the meadow as fast as he can. I'm going to read from the poem now. So, "You have been spotted, and when you and your special friend finally meet, you cling together in joyous reunion, never to be parted again. The happy kisses rain upon your face, your hands again caress the beloved head, and you look once more into the trusting eyes of your pet, so long gone from your life, but never absent from your heart. And then you cross the Rainbow Bridge together." Oh, okay, thank you. I try to avoid this piece of literature at all costs.
Whenever I encounter it online or run into it in a veterinary office, where it will frequently be laminated and tacked to a wall amid pet-themed thank you cards from grateful owners, I avert my eyes the same way I do when approaching something on the road that might be a dead dog, but turns out to be a garden hose. I do this not because the poem is bad, though it certainly is, but because by the third line, my eyes will be glazed with tears, and I will have to make a very conscious effort to shift my thoughts to something less personally upsetting than pet death. For instance, rectal cancer. According to Michael Schaefer's One Union Under Dog, a book I devoured a few years ago, much the same way as a teenager, despite never having owned a dog, I devoured Your Neapolitan Mastiff and You, the Rainbow Bridge emerged sometime in the early 1980s and has been published online at least 35,000 times. The byline almost always appears as anonymous, though several would-be authors have claimed credit over the years. These include a psychologist who says the poem appeared on a dog club's website after he wrote it for a grieving friend, and at least two authors of self-published books about the Rainbow Bridge, one of whom threatened to sue Universal Press Syndicate after it appeared in a Dear Abby column. Over the years, Schaefer explains, the poem has been tweaked to satisfy certain gaps in its logic. There are Christian versions floating around that use scripture to challenge the traditional precept that animals lack souls and therefore cannot go to heaven. There are versions that retrofit the Rainbow Bridge so that it's accessible not just to especially cherished pets, but to all living creatures everywhere. After all, how rainbow-like can a bridge really be if it accommodates the bed-sharing, carefully fed, bathed, and vaccinated animal companions of the world, but not the millions of nameless, tagless, unwashed, and unbrushed creatures that die in shelters or perish on the streets? It would be like saying that the only people who will be reunited with loved ones in the afterlife are those lucky enough to have had a soulmate. On the other hand, an equal access rainbow bridge presents some real problems. Think of the overcrowding, the noise, the poop, and the kennel cough. I imagine arriving at the bridge, fresh from my deathbed, only to wonder if the place I've come to is really a giant municipal dog pound. In other words, hell. What if I've been sentenced to an eternity surrounded by yapping chihuahuas and non-rehabilitatable fighting dogs? What if, and this part is almost too devastating to contemplate, Rex cannot find me among the throngs. What if he stops suddenly and looks into the distance, only to lose all traces of me as quickly as he sensed them? What if I am left to cross the bridge alone, without Rex, like a traveler who's lost his dog on some far-flung highway, a lifetime away from any scent markers of home? This, of course, is worse than death. It's worse than watching Rex die. It's worse, I imagine, than dying myself. It is the absolute essence of abandonment. It is what dying alone would mean to me. So there, I've admitted it. The Rainbow Bridge poem makes me cry because as much as I want to never see it again, I want even more for it to be true. I want Rex to escort me into the afterlife the way he ushered me through real life, at least 13 years of it. I want to believe that Rex will be there when I die because, like anyone, I am afraid of death, and like a lot of owners of especially loved pets, though most are smart enough not to say it out loud, he would bring me more comfort than any other creature, human or otherwise, I can currently think of. It's always said that pets provide unconditional love, but of course that's not true. The pet that is neglected or abused by its owner may try, for his own safety, to satisfy his owner's whims, but he will not love him, unconditionally or otherwise. Humans could take a lesson from this. Unconditional love, as a term, rolls nicely off the tongue, but people say it without meaning it. The idea of loving someone no matter what they do is overrated, not to mention largely impossible. What is unconditional about dogs, about all animals really, but somehow dogs have made an art of it, is their authenticity. No matter where they are or who they're with, dogs are incapable of being anything but themselves. Show me a dog that puts on airs or laughs politely at an unfunny joke, and I'll show you a human in a dog costume, possibly one owned and licensed by the Walt Disney Company. Show me a dog that is sentimental, and I'll show you one of those children's books whose frowning animal characters my mother had to draw smiles on to appease me. And therein lies the irony of the dog exception. I may love dogs because they are so inherently without sap, because they are immune to manufactured emotion or self-engineered cuteness, and yet I express my affection for them in the most sentimental terms imaginable. I dump schmaltz on them by the truckload, cooing over my own charges and cloying baby talk, fawning over strangers' dogs in the park in the manner of a pervert casing the scene at a merry-go-round, writing daily puppy profiles in the first person and slapping them on Facebook in a bid for the same attention craved by parents of toddlers who've mastered their mini commodes. What does it say about the need, the human need for mawkish emotion, that when met with some of the least counterfeit souls on earth, when graced by the presence of creatures for whom affectation is simply incompatible with their DNA, we roll them in sugar as if they were candied apples? What does it mean that people like me, who recoil in the face of culturally enforced cuteness, take the placid tabula rasa that is the essence of dogdom and write all over it in loopy purple letters? I used to think such carrying on was for people who needed to get a life. Now I wonder if such carrying on is proof of life. How can we deny the urge to cover the blank spaces with our gooeyest impulses, to take the unknown and fill it with rainbows and wet, furrylicious kisses? And what is more unknown than the contents of an animal's mind? What do we yearn for more than the knowledge of what our dog is thinking, specifically what he thinks of us? Maybe only death is more unknown. Maybe the only knowledge more prized than a glimpse inside the mind of another living thing is a glimpse inside the end of life itself. And maybe that's because pets are, in a way, living embodiments of death. They guarantee us nothing other than the near certainty that they will leave us well before we leave them. They are ticking bombs that lick our faces. They are pre-scheduled heartbreak. They leave us no choice but to dread the rainbow bridge while secretly hoping it really exists. Our love for our pets is what separates us from the animals. Our love for animals is what makes us human. Which I guess is another way of saying it makes us both totally pathetic and exceedingly blessed. Okay, thank you. I survived. Okay, Leslie? Now, time for Leslie Jameson. And I really hope you have an uplifting thing to say.
That was so cool. Okay. That was amazing. Yeah, it's great to be here. It was absolutely wonderful to hear that out loud, Megan. And I think there's something special about having your own very intense experience with a piece or book, and then getting to be in a room with the author reading it. So thank you, Louise, and Maureen, and Sarah, and everybody who made it possible for me to be here and part of this. I am, appropriately enough, reading a piece, an essay. I'll say a few things about how the essay came to be. It's actually the earliest essay of all the pieces that are in the book, and it came out of this fascination that I started having with two things that felt to me to be pretty universally reviled, at least in the worlds that I was in. And one was sentimentality, and the other was artificial sweeteners, that there was this sort of sense of shame and taboo around both. And I was curious to dig into that and see what we were resisting when we resisted each of them. And I think that there was also a kind of gauntlet I was throwing down for myself about kind of what are the least popular things to defend, and sentimentality seemed to be that. So these are sort of bits and pieces of what that project became. Saccharine is our sweetest word for fear, the fear of too much sentiment, too much taste. When we hear saccharine, we think of language that has shamed us, netted our hearts in trite articulations, words recycled ad nauseam, glutted with feeling to the point of sickness. Sentimentality is an accusation leveled against unearned emotion. Oscar Wilde summed up the indignation. A sentimentalist is simply one who desires to have the luxury of an emotion without paying for it. Artificial sweeteners resonate because they grant the same intensity, sweeter than sugar itself, without the price, no tax of calories. They offer the shell of sugar without its substance. This feels miraculous and hideous at once. This isn't to say that sweeteners are the same as sentimentality, but simply to suggest that a similar fear is operative in both spheres of taste. Both terms describe sweetness that feels shallow, exaggerated, or undeserved, ultimately unreal. The gut reacts toward and against, seeking a vocabulary to contain excess, to name and accuse and banish it. Too much sentiment, unmediated by nuance. Too much sweet, undisciplined by restraint. The hunger for unmitigated and uncomplicated sensation carries on its tongue an unspoken shame. "You are a little soul carrying around a corpse," said Epictetus. I looked that up on Wikipedia before I came here, so I have never pronounced it out loud before. The body is a monstrous thing that turns the soul grotesque, and that sentimental craving for a quick fix of feeling or sudden rush of sweet feels like the emotional equivalent of that cumbersome luggage, corporeal and base, an embarrassing set of desires that our ethereal, higher selves have to lug around. Melodrama is something to binge on. Cupcakes in the closet. We dismiss sentimentality in order to construct ourselves as arbiters of artistry and subtlety, so sensitive we don't need the same crude quantities of feeling, those blunt surfaces, baggy corpses. We will subsist more delicately, we say. We will subsist on less. In a review called Tides of Treacle, James Wood describes the texture of a novelist's sentimentality. Again and again, one catches her in the process of exaggerating a good idea, of adding enough sugar to a mixture already sweet enough. I am trying to remember how I first learned that sentimentality was something I should be running away from. When I packed off for the Iowa Writers' Workshop, I had a set of pretty vague ideas about what I wanted to be writing. I wanted to write stories that were smart and funny and ruthless, but I had no idea what they'd be about. I knew I didn't want to write anything sentimental. So I created characters who hated themselves and disavowed pretty much everything around them. One of the first stories I wrote at the workshop was about a girl named Sophie, whom I'd bequeathed with abysmal self-esteem and a slew of circumstances to justify it. In response to my piece, one guy wrote, "I know someone's going to want to kick me in the balls for saying this, but there are times when it seems like the author is just lining up Sophie's misfortunes. She has a facial deformity that has crippled her self-esteem. She is sexually assaulted. Guys don't like her. She may have an eating disorder, and she's a transfer student." Does anything ever go right for Sophie? It was a fair point. Sophie hated herself because I hated her too. I resented her for coaxing me into writing such a melodramatic story. I hated myself for making her hate herself so much. I wasn't the only one who felt this way. Another guide's critique began like this. "I should start by saying that I did not find any of the characters likable at all. I had to follow characters I had trouble caring about while they did things I had trouble believing they cared about. My fear of too much emotion and my secondary fear of this fear had joined forces to yield an embittered hybrid. I had somehow managed to weave the failures of sentimentality and anti-sentimentality into a single story, summoned an exaggerated string of tragedies, and used them to make sure everybody felt nothing." The truth is, I resist something in sentimentality too. I'm afraid of its inflated gestures and broken promises. But I'm defending it here because I'm just as afraid of what happens when we run away from it. Jadedness, irony, chill. I'm not immune. I've caught myself in all stages of the sentimental guilt-indulgence cycle, clutching tragedy and then fleeing its ramifications, taking refuge in feelings gone frozen in compensation. I envision an interrogated sentimentality that doesn't allow its distortions to be inherited so easily. I want to make a case for the value of that moment when we feel sentimentality punctured, when we feel its flatness revealed, that sense of a vista splitting open or opening out. Something useful happens in that moment of breakage. After the sugar high, always dwells a sharpened sense of everything not sweet. If the saccharin offers some undiluted spell of feeling, oversimplified and unabashedly fictive, then perhaps its value lies in the process of emerging from its thrall, that sense of unmasking, that sense of guilt. We try to wring tears from the stars, but can't ever quite forget the cracked kettles of our attempts or the ways our music is always broken.
All right, thank you so much. As you can see, we have a lot of ground to cover and a lot of intersections. So this is really exciting. But first, I just want to thank the Allowed team. A lot of people like sports teams or other kinds of teams, but the Allowed team is my favorite team. So thank you. So before we get to topics or subjects, I want to talk about genre just a little bit. So the word essay is associated with words like attempt and trial and way. So I'd like to hear how each of you defines the essay as you practice it. How about Leslie first? How do you think of the essay?
Yeah. It's funny because I feel like along with the rise of the essay in the past few years has come like the rise of the etymology of the essay, you know, and those words. Especially attempts come up, but to me there really is something quite true actually in that word, or what it feels like to craft an essay. And for me, I think that sense of the essay as having the texture and feel of an attempt comes from a couple different things. One is more in my history and one is more general, but because I was always a fiction writer, like it was what I'd done since I was young, it was what I like studied in school, like so I felt like at a certain point when I sat down to write fiction, I was accompanied by all the voices in the workshop. I mean, obviously, when I was writing essays, I was accompanied by some of them enough to quote them word for word. But when I was practicing the craft of fiction, I was having this sort of this set of implicit or explicit rules and the sense of writing for an audience and the sense, even if I didn't want it, of what it was supposed to look like or how it was supposed to happen. And essays were just this experiment that I started doing when the fiction stopped feeling like it was yielding as much. So I think there was a sense of fewer rules and more possibility for just kind of doing what I wanted. The sentimentality essay was one where I had sort of bits and pieces of my life and then a lot of literary criticism and then riffing on cultural history. I mean, it felt legitimately like a grab bag. And I think that prerogative to sort of mix up different methods, to put criticism alongside interviews, to put your own life alongside the lives of others, like being able to do that felt less like innovation and more like just honoring how things actually feel and are in lived experience. So
it's the closest thing to that feeling.
Yeah, I had sort of a similar experience. I went to MFA program writing fiction, and this was back in the early 90s, and creative nonfiction, you know, oxymoron of the century, was not really a thing. It was just starting a little bit, and so it didn't really occur to me to do it. And I kind of thought, well, if you want to be a writer, you're either like a newspaper reporter or a novelist. And, you know, I read a lot of, you know, criticism and stuff in between, but I somehow hadn't put it together that there was this other way to go. So I was writing really mediocre short stories, Laurie Moore knockoff short stories, which was like, you know, was the requirement if you were a girl writer, you know, in the 80s and you know, during that time. So I felt that the stories were not so fruitful. And I'm somebody who thinks in terms of ideas more than plot. So my stories tended to be, you know, sort of meandering and ruminating and sort of chewing on something more than like having a plot. And so my workshop classmates had quite a lot to say about that as well. I ended up just taking a nonfiction workshop and stumbling into the genre, and it just really clicked for pretty much all the reasons that Leslie says. And I guess to answer your initial question, I see the essay as a suggestion. Mm. You know, it is to try, it is to, you know, ruminate, all those things, but it's really more just an invitation to the reader to think alongside me as I try to figure something out. And that's true in my column, in my newspaper column, which I really see as a little mini essay I do every week. So that's true for a short piece, but also a really long piece. It's a suggestion and an invitation.
Yeah, I love that word, invitation. It just gets at the interactive moment of writing and reading, which reminds me of this label of confessional that I know Megan pushes back against.
We're going to have a duel because Leslie's pro confessional, aren't you? Are you? You're a.
No, I mean,
she's an apologist. She's a confession apologist.
I think that one thing we can say for sure is that columnists at Slate enjoy dueling us in precisely that way. When I read the piece that said I was pro-confessional, my first thought was, oh, am I? And then I tried to look up
whatever Slate says, that's what you are. So, yes.
Well, yeah. So where is the line? There's confessional, there's personal. Are they the same thing? Are they different? Where are you on the spectrum?
I think it's probably so semantic.
Where are you on this rainbow?
I think we're probably pretty close, and it's just a matter of the how you feel about the word is my feeling, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me, I think that part of how the word confessional has been used is it has really been turned into this kind of scapegoat for a lot of accusations that I think are more deeply felt about personal writing or writing that draws on the life of the author in some way. So I think when people, or at least a lot of times when people attack confessional, I think that part of what they're pushing at is this idea that when somebody writes about his own life or her own life, that she's looking for certain things, that she's looking for absolution, that she's looking for sympathy, that she's looking for admiration. And so I think that the attack on the confessional is partially like, I attack you for looking for my pity, or I attack you for sort of putting your wounds on display so openly. And I very much push back against that kind of attack, because I think there are all kinds of reasons that people write about their own lives, and certainly, you know, to sort of assume the desires of the writer in invoking his or her own life, I think, just puts all these things on the table that I actually think are really readerly desires, that are desires for the writer to need something from you, the reader. So I'm really interested in, like, interrogating all of those fantasies, I think, of, like, how much intimacy or exposure is really happening on the page. I think insofar as confessional implies, like, you're confessing something you've done wrong, like, I think so much personal writing isn't doing that at all. But I think I have gotten kind of interested in defending confessional just because I want to open up that conversation and sort of ask people to question what it is they're really trying to take down with that term. So,
I think, too, confession, if you accuse, or if you suggest that somebody is confessional, you're sort of dismissing the whole notion of craft.
Yeah.
I mean, what we're doing is, when we write, when you do any sort of creative pursuit, is you're choosing. You're choosing certain details. You're choosing what to include. You're choosing what to leave out. And I always say, you know, this might seem incredibly candid, but for everything I have included in here that seems revealing, there are about 500 things I chose not to include. And you know, it's always tempting to talk about, you know, the experience of reading something or you know, any kind of relationship between creativity and the audience as, you know, you're as if you're absorbing this person, but you're really absorbing you're absorbing something that they've created and that has been very deliberately crafted.
Absolutely.
And I think that's an important consideration.
Well, and part of one of the things that I loved about the construction of your book is that in the Joni Mitchell problem, when you talk about Joni Mitchell's work, you're sort of addressing that issue head on about sort of the mistakes that people make when they read her songs or listen to her songs as sort of just gushings of her entire selfhood. But it's smart because it's also reflecting back on ways in which your own work
The essay, The Joni Mitchell Problem, is basically a primer on how to read The Unspeakable. And it's been so interesting because a lot of, you know, there have been a couple critics who are like, I don't know, this random piece about a singer. Yeah. I don't know what it's doing.
No, but it makes the distinction between letting it all hang out and putting yourself out there.
Yes.
And those are not the same thing. To quickly tell them about where the burden of the reading experience goes. There's like the difference between the two. I think
it's
so valuable.
Well, I mean, I think that, when you read these things, I mean, we're in this moment where there's so much stuff on the internet, and, you know, on a very practical level, it's just cheaper for editorial outlets to publish personal pieces because they haven't had to pay anyone to go out and do interviews and research it. And so there's just a lot of this stuff. We're seeing a lot of it. Some of it is really great. Some of it tends to kind of amount to a lot of anxiety on the page. And it's almost sometimes feels to me like the reader is asking the audience to forgive her or him and treating it as a sort of cathartic experience for the writer. And that, to me, is not appropriate. I mean, that's for a first draft. To then go and publish your first draft, which unfortunately is very easy to do now on the internet, and there are plenty of editors who are happy to facilitate that, to do that is really not fair, I think, to the reader, because that's not what the artistic process is. You know?
Absolutely. Nor is it it's not necessarily closer to the truth of the experience or the point of the writing.
There's this really great, probably both of you have read it, but this really great piece called The Semi-Autobiographers. I'm now forgetting her name. Emily. It's Emily something. But that's about how we sort of associate first drafts with authenticity, sort of first version, best version, or first version, most honest version, and this idea that piece is really, sort of refusing that notion in a lot of, to me, really compelling ways and saying maybe the more processed, digested, metabolized, crafted version of a thing is the more honest version, which I think gets really to your point, which I totally agree with, about how sort of seeing everything as exposure is forgetting about craft and forgetting about the way that, the pieces of mine that are more personal are almost always edited, drafted and redrafted many more times than the pieces of mine that are more critical or
that's
reported.
Interesting.
Yeah, because I think that I do sort of know that the first version is probably going to have a lot of agendas that aren't going to be visible or available to me as I'm writing it. And sort of that means that when I look back at it, there's all sorts of stuff that I see in it that's like, this was me wanting something or me sort of evading a truth or me not understanding something yet. Or there's just all this sort of murky business the first time around. So
And you cut through it slowly but surely. Hopefully.
Or make some progress. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So is there like in this cutting or changing, is there something you specifically try to take out? Like what gets taken out first, or what do you struggle with removing? Is there a category or a type?
It depends. A case by case basis. It depends what the piece is. I mean, there was the first essay in The Unspeakable is this essay called Matricide, which was like an incredibly brutal piece and took me forever. And it was like I'd write two sentences and take away three. It was just like kind of walking backwards. And a lot of stuff was happening there, in the early drafts. There was a lot of stuff that just sounded like whining and complaining. And, perhaps it didn't all. We never know if we've excised everything. But that was coming up a lot in that piece. There are other pieces where it's like, oh, this sounds angry. Like, I think there's a kind of, each kind of writing project is in a particular key.
Yeah.
And if you kind of hit the same note too many times, that's something that's both natural but also needs to be attended to.
So kind of testing out the tone.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, I really agree that sort of each piece for me invites its own writing mistakes, and then I have to sort of look out for those. But I mean, one thing that I can say I do often see or I end up noticing and then like sort of feeling preemptively ashamed of and trying to reckon with in some way is like, if I'm writing about an experience I've had that I've also narrated to people in my life, like, or some aspect of it I've narrated, I'll start to see it's almost like a little gloss or sheen on the page. Like, I'll see the way that I told that story, like the way I got comfortable telling that story. Like, oh, well, you know, it was like the 10-month mark in the relationship, and I always ended relationships at the 10-month mark. You know, like, we have these narratives of our own lives that become like little mini mythologies. And so I try to look for those, like, this is the groove that became familiar to me in narrating this experience. And here, once again, I've kind of fallen into that groove. So when the formulation looks overly familiar, I can sort of hear my cocktail party voice telling it. Then I'm like, okay, I know I need to somehow dig deeper there.
So. Right, too smooth.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting, really interesting. Yeah. Just thinking back to the pieces that each of you chose to read and how they really intersect at the idea of sentimentality. And I want to know why. What really is wrong with sentimentality or feeling, or why is it a hot subject for each of you? How did you become interested in it?
All of my writing always kind of circles around these themes, and I don't know. I mean, I could give the sort of very mundane, practical answer, which is that I moved around a lot as a kid, and I had a mother who was very performative and sort of tended to perform herself and our family rather than have like a kind of sense of it as a you know, authentic static object. So I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's sort of one version, and I think that a whole bunch of things can be true at the same time. I mean, we can you know, be armchair shrinks about ourselves, but you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that I think I really respond to that comes up, I mean, in lots of ways in your collection, but explicitly in that, in your framing of that piece, was this idea of sort of a vision of sentimentality as sort of prescribed feelings, mm-hmm. or cultural scripts around feelings and sort of what feelings we're supposed to have. And I think that kind of, I mean, I deeply agree with the project of sort of vocalizing like unofficial emotions or like inappropriate emotions, or sort of pushing back against this idea that like if X, then one is supposed to feel Y. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested, I mean, what I've been thinking about over the course of this presentation so far is like the difference between sentimentality as culturally prescribed feeling and the kind of sentimentality that's about sort of gushy, unmediated, overly simple feeling or something. Because I think those are two maybe related, but sort of mm-hmm. two slightly different understandings or two different shades of that term, but I think that they come together maybe in the form of the Hallmark card or something like that, which is like in this situation you are supposed to feel this simple, uncomplicated thing.
Or the Facebook yeah. post where everyone just gushes like, yeah. oh, you know, amazing, looking good. I feel like, have you noticed this? Like if you, the exclamation point has become this mandate. So if you write an email and you just say like, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing you, period. It's like, you're kind of a jerk. Have you noticed this? You know, it's sort of like, you're kind of like not, you're sort of a, you know, one robotic and monotone. And you have to be like, hey, or like, you know, sorry, I can't see you, exclamation point. And that's okay. But if you were just like, I can't see you.
Should we just eliminate punctuation? Would that help?
No, because there's always that person who emails you who doesn't have punctuation. It's always a relative, and it's always somebody who has no punctuation, and it's this incredible like pity and rage emerge from these emails.
I like that. I like that idea, though, punctuation inflation as like the sort of problem of our time.
You own that.
But I think I also owned it because I caused it. I mean, I think I am the person who's
no, I mean, you own the phrase. You own the expression.
I know, but
point.
I'm saying I think that I know it so well because I actually have reached the point in my own emails where they not only deploy like many exclamation points, but it become exclamation point self-referential where I'll be like, oh, I'm about to use another one, and then
right.
you know, because I
put it in parentheses.
I feel
yeah.
the hunger coming on. But.
I know, isn't that? It's really interesting. I guess it's just evolved from texting and emailing, and yeah.
But it's kind of cool to think about like what punctuation or really what words can do. I mean, this connection between, you know, how we express ourselves and the feelings behind them, and sort of the connection there. I mean, I guess what I'm really thinking of is, you know, since I realized we were going to do this program, I've been following empathy in the news a little bit. And there's always something about how, you know, empathy is so much easier when you think about one individual versus all of like Sudan, You know, you have to have a specific face to it, or empathy is a choice, or it's not a choice. So, well, I guess, what is, just tell us what empathy is. Give, just help me out here.
This is like a pretty good summation of the last year and a half of my life. I think, I mean, I guess I roughly think of empathy as like imagining oneself into another person's state of feeling. But I do think, I mean, I'm talking about sort of duals or constructed duals, like one of the most interesting aspects for me of sort of speaking about empathy in a bit is that I've gotten positioned in conversations several times with this wonderful psychologist at Yale named Paul Bloom, who mm-hmm. sort of carved out this position for himself in the public eye as like being against empathy, which is like a position that has a lot of traction because, as he writes, it's like being against puppies. You know, it's like who's against empathy. So, I think he's sort of positioned himself there because it's visible and provocative. I mean, I think really what he's against is sort of substituting feeling for reasoning or something like that. But mm-hmm. part of what he talks about is like there are certain perils that can attach to following empathy in a totally uninterrogated way. Things like it's easier to empathize with an individual than a systemic problem or like a society-wide problem. And so like if we follow sort of empathy, if we put our sense of urgency or our sense of what needs to be done, if we attach it too firmly to like a story that makes us feel something, like that's actually not thinking about like an effective use of resources or effective policy choices in the same way that sort of pulling back and getting a more aerial view could. So I think to me it's interesting to think about the way that sort of a larger kind of systemic vision could like harness itself to the energy of how our empathy actually sort of naturally or organically arises, sort of how can we use this sort of compassion that comes in response to an individual story to sort of think about motivating people into living or giving or voting differently. So
yeah, and tying that into literature too, it's like that the fact that reading something can, you know, bring out a sense of empathy or get people to think about it in a way that's more active seems to contain a lot of possibilities. And
well, I was going to say, I think Leslie does this so beautifully. Like you do this thing where you're working out an idea, but we see you working it out. Like there's something very intrinsically, is it empathic or empathetic? First of all, okay.
I feel like
you could go either.
I think empathetic, but I'm totally guilty of using both. Sometimes
if we learn nothing tonight other than.
Oh, good.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Open this
Thank
out.
You.
Yeah.
But empathetic just sounds like has pathetic in it. So you don't want that. Anyway, but there's something, you know, with Leslie's essays, you know, part of what's so magical about them often is that we're seeing the narrator discovering it. You know, we see you looking something up, or we see you thinking about this, or we see you remembering. Like you're physically putting us in the space, but also kind of going off on these really sort of abstract tangents. And it's a great technique, I think. And that is inherently, it creates an intimacy, which I think is inherently empathic.
No, for both, the experience of reading these books back to back and then rereading them for this, I felt like I was getting in the car with each of you. It was like me in the passenger seat and along for the ride, which is a great feeling for a reader, just to feel kind of, you know, strapped in.
Strapped in has a sort of sinister.
Yeah, I don't know.
Sounds safe. Right. Yeah. I didn't safe.
Who was driving though?
You.
Oh, we were. Oh,
you.
Oh, I see.
You.
I see. Oh, I thought we were all in the car.
Oh no, we were in different cars.
Okay.
It was like it was a Subaru here and maybe a Saab for Leslie.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure.
I've had both of those cars.
Oh, well, maybe. Yeah. Maybe I'm confused.
Died miserable deaths.
And on that subject of like, you know, sort of the journey that the essay goes on, in both your collections, there are interesting boundaries between each essay where there'll be repetitions of a certain theme or subject. So in Leslie's book, for example, there's she's attacked in Nicaragua, and that subject recurs. In Megan's book, there's several, but the one that comes to mind for me is this freak illness. So why pull these threads through? What do they do for the book or for each essay? What's the connecting tie?
Well, I mean, the first, The Unspeakable, all of the essays were written specifically to be in the book. It's not a collection of essays that have been published elsewhere, and I very deliberately did that. I wanted them to be designed to be in this book in the company of each other. It kind of felt like it was like an album. It's like album oriented book, you know. So the first piece was about my mother dying and my grandmother dying in the same year, and then I guess it just felt natural to sort of bookend, have the last piece be about this freak illness that I had. Actually, my husband suggested that I go get my medical records, because mm-hmm. what had happened, we don't have to go into it, but I was in a medically induced coma for about 5 days. And so my husband had suggested that I go get the medical records and try to, like, you know, juxtapose sort of what I was ever thinking about with what was actually going on. And it was a really good idea.
Yeah. And that's a form that Leslie uses as well, mm-hmm. which is really cool. The medical report
as
a floor of the essay.
Yeah, like an alternate genre. Yeah. I mean, I think it's an interesting question about recurrence, because I don't know, part of how personal experience shows up in my writing, and this gets back to the question of craft, is it's less often that I deeply want to share something with the world, and more often that I'm trying to think through some question or some issue, and something that's happened to me feels like a useful way of thinking through that issue, largely because, like, the life experiences that I know best are my own, because my life is the one that I've lived. So that's kind of the material that's ready to hand in a certain way. So it's like sometimes the same experience will show up in different pieces because it's useful to me to think through not just one particular question or problem, but a couple of different questions or problems. So, like, they're getting hit in Nicaragua, which is up a couple times in that collection. There's one piece where I'm sort of thinking through how some stories are hard to tell, and that had become a hard story for me to tell. So I'm sort of thinking about it in that context. And then there's another piece where I'm thinking about sort of cultural reactions to women narrating their own pain. And so I sort of think about it in that context as well. But the experience is really sort of, it's never just being said for its own sake. Or at least my hope is that it's not being said for its own sake. It's being sort of deployed in the service mm-hmm. of something else, but it can be deployed in the service of different things. So.
Interesting, really interesting. I'm going to end on a question about endings. So, optional. Answer one or the other of these two questions. One, how do you know when you're done? Two, do you resist happy endings?
But finishing is a happy ending.
Ah. Three.
Oh.
No.
Okay. That's all I have to say. I know when you're done, when it's due. That's often when it is due. Yeah.
I mean, I guess I think I'm gonna choose a second. I think I do. I think I do resist happy endings, not on principle, but because so often it feels like the ending of one story is actually sort of the floor dropping out to show that you're in a bigger room than you thought you were, or something mm-hmm. like that. Like, I don't know. I went through a phase where I felt like every piece that I wrote, I was ending with a question mark, because I never felt like I was, like, getting to, I had sort of become so anti-resolution, and I decided I needed to, like, that had become its own sort of addiction to sort of always bowing out into the question. But I think that my attachment to the question mark was at least one phase of the resistance to the happy ending. But I think I often like to do something where I'm sort of like, well, even if this story is resolved, like, actually, it's part of this, you know, larger story. I'm thinking about a piece of mine that I wrote about that trio of documentaries about the West Memphis Three, these mm-hmm. guys who were imprisoned for a crime they didn't commit. And, you know, I sort of end that piece by sort of juxtaposing the fact that their story had a happy ending because they were eventually not exonerated, they were released from prison, largely because a lot of celebrities got behind their cause and dumped a lot of money into it. But the point remains that, like, the American justice system is still, like, deeply flawed. And so I sort of wanted the essay to, like, look at that in its closing glance rather than sort of settle just on the fact that these particular men had some small fragment of justice restored to them in the end. So,
and I think that's really what the heart of the essay is. I think most successful essays are not going to tell you what to think. I mean, I think saying, you know, justice has been served and okay, like that's not really an essay. I mean, I think the essay, because it's a suggestion, it's an invitation, you're sort of saying, okay, you know, now let's go and think about this mm-hmm. bigger thing. You know, it's opening, which is exactly what you're saying.
So the essay is not an exclamation point, it's a question mark.
Well, as you were talking, I was saying, now I'm sure that you've moved from question mark to exclamation point.
That's true. That would be a great, each essay now, just
yeah.
a couple.
Oh
yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Well, I think we just invented something new right here.
Yeah.
I think we should open up for questions, for more question marks.
Thank you all very much. Unspeakable, would you speak about that and how it relates to your collection of essays? Our book club read your book, and why we're here.
The word itself, the unspeakable. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, getting back to this idea of you know, the sort of mandate to experience things a certain way, and you know, the notion of feeling like you should sort of convey your experiences, particularly your traumatic experiences, in a certain way. It kind of led back to this idea of what's the most unspeakable thing. I mean, for me, in the piece about my mother, the most unspeakable, there was like terrible things happening. My mother was dying brutally. My grandmother died, you know, but my mother and my grandmother had this horrible relationship. And the worst part of my mother actually having cancer and her mother dying was the fact that her mother died the same week as my mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and the worst part of it was that my mother was not going to have any time on earth as a healthy person free of her mother. Okay, so that's like a horrible thing to say. Horrible thing to say. But that was really true. That was really, it was this unspoken thing in our family, and everybody knew it. Everybody knew that this was really the worst part of this. And so on a very literal level, like that was the unspeakable. And then I think on a more metaphorical level, you know, at the end of the last essay, I have aphasia. I get this crazy illness and I'm deteriorating and I literally become unable to speak. I have aphasia. I can't find my words. So, I mean, you know, it's all, it works on, hopefully works on a bunch of different levels.
So this is probably an easy one for you guys. What's the difference between compassion and empathy?
Mm. Oof. Spelling. No.
For me, I mean, one sort of shading of the difference might have to do with whether something is more about imagination or sort of cognitively taking yourself into what somebody might feel, rather as opposed to sort of feeling something towards them. Like compassion to me suggests like a real feeling towards where somebody's at or what they're inside of, and empathy can involve or elicit feeling, but it's kind of is about understanding or sort of taking yourself cognitively into what they feel. So
maybe the word compassion, the word compassion has sort of been commercialized, I feel. Like, I feel empathy is still has a little kind of, you know, street cred in a way. Compassion is just like, have compassion. It's sort of like, be nice, you know. There is that element.
Yeah, it's a little bossy.
To the word, yeah.
Question about empathy in terms of feeling it and when you talked about the psychiatrist and the debate you were having, it triggered even deeper in me. Don't we use empathy to not care about a bigger problem? In other words, I could relate to a dog dying and an individual's pain, but what I'm not doing is transferring that to dealing with all the dogs on the street or dogs without owners. Is that not a problem with empathy?
Well, I think it's such a useful thing to point out that there's not necessarily always a cause and effect relationship between experiencing empathy and doing good, right? That's a less stable relationship than we sometimes want to imagine it to be. I mean, there's this concept in psychology called the altruism hypothesis, which is like basically positing that when we feel empathy, we do good in some way. And I think it's absolutely right that it doesn't always work that way. I mean, I guess I would also push back against the idea that it always doesn't work that way, or that somehow empathy it always obstructs or sort of inoculates us against doing some larger good. But I think it's the real question of empathy is like, what happens next? You know, does that empathy sort of lead into something that actually changes or sort of acts towards the world, or does it kind of, is it its own conclusion as a feeling? And I think there can be a real danger in that. So.
I mean, what she said.
Are each of you, can you describe that moment when something goes off in your mind and you, I need to write about that, or that could be an essay. At dinner tonight, I was saying something and Molly said, you should write about that. And I was like, oh, right. And immediately like a little kind of something formed. Do you recognize those moments, or can you describe them at all when something goes off and you can tell that there's a new direction, a new subject?
Well, I have to write a column all the time, so I believe I said to you, I should write a column about that, but
yes,
I won't.
That's true.
I think on a sort of like micro level, I constantly have to generate, you know, so I'm always looking for things, but that's a little bit different. I mean, yeah, when I think I do, I'm curious how if you've experienced this, where you're sort of like living your life and you're thinking like, oh, I'm experiencing this thing right now, but I think it would make a really great essay. And then I think that's a terrible way to live your life. Like, what is that? And that's totally messed up. But then, or I am going to experience this thing and I bet it would be good. That's even worse.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of a coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't always bear fruit, but sometimes it does. And I don't know. I will leave it to you to...
On that, I mean, I absolutely do identify with that feeling of either being inside a moment and then thinking about it as something that might get narrated, or, you know, I think members of my family have asked, like, oh, is every moment fair game, or like, could this moment someday be narrated? Or, you know, so it's not a feeling I alone have. Maybe I have it in a more productive sense rather than a sort of fearful or resentful sense. But like, I do think for me at least, sometimes there can be a positive side to that idea of like, maybe someday this will be narrated, because both is a coping mechanism, but also sometimes I can be naturally an extremely sort of introverted, fearful person. And I think sometimes when I think, oh, I might someday write about this, or if I'm inside of a like some kind of assignment that I know I will someday write about because I have to write about it, it elicits a part of me that's like slightly more outgoing and seeking and curious. So I think insofar as there is a positive side to that kind of like narration double consciousness, it can sometimes be that sort of like pushing me over certain thresholds of just like talking to strangers basically that I wouldn't necessarily go over otherwise.
Yeah, I think it helps you be a little more fearless in a way.
Like a dare.
Sort of seeking moments, yeah.
Yeah.
Often I feel like, to Louise's question, like I often feel less like the idea of maybe writing about something, it feels less like a sort of light going off and more like something getting under my skin. Not always like that I feel irritated or bad about it, but just that something is like, my thoughts keep coming back to it. I feel like I don't understand something about it, or it's like tugging at my sleeve repeatedly, and then I have, well, he's unfinished business with it. So, yeah.
Do you feel that you write about feelings and empathy differently than a man would write about them? If so, how so? If not, why not?
I mean, I guess maybe this is a cop-out answer, but I guess I feel like I write about them differently than anybody else would write about them, male or female. And I don't mean that in a way like better or anything. I just do feel like the way every person sort of metabolizes or makes sense of feeling is different. And I think that there are patterns that maybe we can notice across gender. And I think a lot of those are culturally reinforced, you know, about sort of how we process feeling. And you know, some of my writing does try to look directly at how gender inflects sort of how stories are received, or which in turn sort of inflects how stories are told. And, you know, I do think that sometimes there can be, I wrote this one piece about how sort of baggage attaches to women talking about pain. And I absolutely think that baggage attaches to men talking about pain too. I just think that the sort of shadings of that baggage are probably different. I think it maybe gets suppressed or resisted for different reasons. So.
And you, Megan?
I'm not really conscious of writing like a woman. Certainly you're going to be read like a woman. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of what happens is that there's all sorts of expectations and assumptions, and it becomes very freighted, especially when you're writing about yourself. I mean, it kind of comes down to this, you know, I've talked about this before. I think when everybody, but maybe even particular sometimes, when women write, take a stance, are candid, whatever it is, they are then called brave. Well, that was so brave of you. That was so brave. And that, it just drives me crazy, because I always tell my students this, like, don't be brave. Do your job. Like, you're writers. Our job as writers is to say things and think about things and articulate them in a way that maybe other people are thinking and wondering about, but for whatever reason, can't put words to, don't want to say out loud, whatever it is. Like, that's not being brave. That's being in a privileged position to do this job, which is a great privilege, I think. And so, and I would love to know if the brave thing is put on men as much as it is on, mm. on women, you know.
Yeah.
So.
I have a question in converse of Louisa's. You're writing on demand. Do you ever fear that you're going to run out of things that you really want to write about?
Yes. I have been writing my LA Times column this is my 10th year. I cannot Oof. Believe it. Don't applaud. Do not applaud, because it is not, that is not, but it's been, you know, so there is this, like, it is a treadmill. I mean, I love doing it, and I love it as an essayist, and I love that I've been able to do, it's a weird column. It's not, you know, I'm not a pundit, and I do different things. But yeah, with the column, I'm constantly afraid that I'm not going to have something to say. And I really try to say something original. I have a pretty low tolerance for recycling, you know, stuff that's going around. And unfortunately, there's so many opinions flying around all the time that it's very hard to avoid dovetailing on somebody's. So yeah, in that sense, yes. In terms of like the big pieces, you know, the stuff like that's in this book, I know, because I just think it's just kind of the way I live my life is, you know, this is a filter. And I guess, you know, I would run out of things to say if I died, I suppose. So, and I do fear dying. So yes. So yes.
Well, I don't write on demand in the same way as Megan does. So I'm probably less equipped to answer. I mean, my one sort of on demand job is I write these columns for the New York Times, but they always, the way that column is framed is two columnists responding to one question. So there's always, in a sense, something that I am being asked to respond to. So I always have that starting prompt, and it's sort of an elaborate algorithm how it all happens. But I always choose what I'm responding to too. So and often we can also suggest questions. So if there's something we want to write about, we usually get to. So I think in that way, I find, even though sometimes my editor and I have conversations about how much my column is, in fact, responding to the prompt, there is always there's always at least something there that's giving me traction, and it's something that I've been curious about. But I think it would be hard for me to have a regular column, probably, because I'm not sure that I, yeah.
Well, you write that column pretty regularly. Yeah. I think it is great to have a prompt.
Yeah.
Do you personally, do you feel empathic or empathetic? How would you quantify that for yourselves, and has that changed after you've explored these topics in so in depth? Has it increased, decreased, just overall, or is there even such a thing as that relativity?
I have no empathy whatsoever. I don't know. I don't think.
I don't know.
Have they spent their empathy by writing about it? Is that a...
Well, I wasn't writing about empathy, okay? That's on Leslie. And I was writing about unspeakability. And
sentiment. And the requirements of it.
And I guess I have become more unspeakable.
I think it's a really interesting question. I'm not sure that I'm the best person, maybe to turn it to my husband or something like that, to ask about whether I am more or less empathetic than I used to be. I mean, one thing that I can say is that I often feel a disconnect between sort of the occupying the posture or position of other people asking me, like, you know, what is empathy all about, or, you know, define it, or, you know, explain it, or something, becoming like asked to be some sort of expert on it, which, you know, I mean, this gets back to what we were saying about the form of the essay. I feel like the last thing that I would ever do in writing essays is like proclaim myself an expert on anything, but like feeling what I feel in my lived experience of the world is just constant deficits in my empathy and constant deficits. And I think this gets to the question that Gentleman in Back asked, like constant deficits in terms of like, what good does any empathy that I feel actually do in the world? So I think, I don't know whether I've gotten more or less empathetic, but I feel like thinking a lot about empathy has only made me feel more sort of sensitive to, ashamed about, sort of aware of sort of the limits of what I do as a human in the world, or what good my feelings or emotions do. So writing increases self-loathing. I don't know what the moral of that
was. Well, publishing increases self-loathing.
Both essays at times seem to flow into poetry. And I was wondering if the essay is an uncondensed poem. Have either of you written poetry, or have you ever related?
I have not really. That's interesting. Yeah, I think the essay is so many different things. I mean, that's why I love it. It's in one piece. You can have reporting. You can have criticism. You can have memoir. I mean, I had to say I read a lot of, like, film criticism, you know, when I was a kid, actually. I was a total nerd. I was like, I read a lot of Pauline Kael. So I think that more than a poet, I think I'm a critic. And I also come from a family of musicians, so I'm very attentive to sound, and I'm very sensitive to rhythm. And so I think maybe, to answer your question, I approach it more musically than poetically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess that what you were saying about sound resonates a lot for me. I think that often my writing process is driven by rhythm and image, and so that I'm often find that I'm following rhythms towards the next sentence, the next idea, and often part of my editing process has to be, or I at least want it to be, sort of interrogating whether my following of rhythms was actually sort of conceptually bearing fruit or conceptually sound. Sort of, was I writing towards the sound of the pretty sentence, or do I really mean what I'm saying here? So I think sometimes I write into the poetic, and then have to ask myself sort of whether that is like a load bearing structure or not. I did write poetry when I was younger, and I think that came from that feeling of attachment to sound. I also think that some of my essays are structured around sort of gathering different pieces and then bringing those pieces into relation. So I think that sometimes the patterns of how that looks are also have something to do with the logic of poems, or how poems can sort of set images out and then place those images in a kind of pattern. So. Hmm.
These books are beautiful inside and out. They will look great on your bookshelf. So please get them signed in the lobby. And thank you very much for coming tonight.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.